Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, pretty baby, since you left me, I have been feeling oh so blue. I always thought that you would love me. I don't know what I should do. Do do.
For joining me again here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. As always, I am your host, Maria Wall. And tonight, we have a very special guest with us tonight to end out our celebration of Men Month. I believe in something called divine timing. And for whatever reason, everything worked out yet again for this month. Tonight, our special guest is Lisa Ann Estich. She is the author of Soaring Above Co-Addiction, Helping Your Loved One Get Clean While Creating the Life of Your Dreams. And with that said, let me give you a little bit of background on Lisa. After nearly two decades of living through the turbulence of an addictive relationship, Lisa created a plan to gain back control of her life. She discovered through the process of making her own improvements that her husband began to make positive changes of his own. Eventually, he accepted treatment, and now they are enjoying a healthy marriage. And I am happy to say that he is now, has now been clean 5 years, clean and sober. So with that said, I'd love to welcome Lisa to our show. Lisa, are you there?
Hi, Maria. Thank you so much for having me. I am here.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for joining me here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. And as I had told you briefly when we were speaking earlier, that this book is so powerful because I know that you are speaking about, of course, living with someone with addictions such as alcohol and or drugs, but this book can really help people who are dealing with any type of a taxing or toxic relationship in so many ways because, you know, it's so amazing how the responses and the outcomes are so similar when, you know, people are in these types of relationships. So we are just going to get started and tell us a little bit about how it all began for you, when you knew what you had gotten yourself into.
Well, you know, it started really at the very beginning of our marriage. My husband and I married at a very young age. We were teenage sweethearts, and at that time when we were dating, there definitely was plenty of drinking going on. A lot of the time we spent together was at parties, and I knew that my husband did do cocaine when we would go to these parties. And honestly, at that time as a teenager, it was happening a lot around us at parties, and I didn't think of it as an addiction at that point because I was just so young and that was going on. We had decided that we wanted to move in together. I was 18 and he was 20. And around the time that we were getting ready to move out together, we found out that we were pregnant. And so we made what seemed like the next logical step, which is to get married and start our family. And at that time, I realized I was naive, and I really believed that we were going to move forward in a new stage in our lives and that the partying was kind of part of our teenage past. And when we first got married and that didn't happen, I assumed that once our child was born, my husband Dean would grow out of it. But of course, when my child was born, that didn't really happen. Although I do look back at those first few years of our marriage with very fond memories. We had this beautiful son we adored. My husband was making great money for his age, which allowed me to stay home and take care of our son, which was just wonderful. I loved being at home taking care of our son. And we had a lot of passion and love in our relationship. And even though there was definitely, you know, drinking and he would do drugs fairly regularly, and that definitely caused tension and some problems in our relationship. At that time, you know, I guess it really didn't serve me to face it, because if I did, I would then have to make some sort of change. And the truth was, I didn't want to change this new life that I was in. I adored, you know, my life as far as being home, taking care of my son, taking care of my home, being a wife and mother. It really fit me well. And I didn't want to give that up. And so I think I, even though knew very early on in our marriage, I chose not to face it because I didn't want to really face it. And as the years went by, the addiction gradually got worse. And I think because I was so young, I kind of grew into very codependent patterns. And I really was living in a bit of a bubble. My whole life revolved around my husband and my son. And I found that over time, really, I lost myself. You know, when my husband was doing good and feeling great, I was on top of the world. And when my husband was doing poorly and doing bad and in a bad mood, I was miserable. And so my feelings and emotions really began to mirror his feelings and emotions, and I really did lose myself. But it was very early in our relationship I knew that there was a problem, but it took a long, long time for me to face up to it. And then by then, I was, you know, probably a decade had gone by, and so I really had a difficult time getting out of those codependent patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so then eventually I did get a job that I was surprised at how much I loved working, and it started this new exciting time in my life. My son was 8 years old at that time. But around the same time that I started working, my husband was introduced to crack cocaine. And for anybody who loves somebody who becomes addicted to a drug like crack cocaine, it's very difficult to accept that somebody you love is addicted to that. It's hard to even say, let alone admit it to other people. And things really, really, really spiraled out of control in our lives at that point. And then started really a lot of years of, even though there were problems earlier in our marriage, definitely with addiction, when crack cocaine entered the picture, we entered a very dark time. Our whole family did. And it was, you know, things that he did for his addiction were unthinkable, really. And I fell into really deep depression along with my husband and had a very difficult time getting out of it. And some things happened that really made me open my eyes and realize what was going on, that I had to get out of the situation. I found myself chasing a drug dealer throughout our neighborhood, you know, one time in my car, and I went to a drug dealer's house and knocked on his door and confronted him, and I was doing these things that were crazy. And I finally realized that I was just as out of control as my husband in this, and that's when I really started to turn things around. But it took about 15 to 16 years in our marriage before I was able to really start making changes for myself to get out of the patterns that had formed.
Right. And one thing that I noticed in the book was that you had given even another example of Jim and Mary and their relationship, which is pretty similar. They had you know, two young children, and he had his addictions. And that's when I was telling you earlier that, you know, it's amazing how we all end up in that same way. We lose ourselves somehow while we're trying to help or support, or in some cases, some people are under the false impression that they can just up and change the individual, when that really is not the case at all. I believe at one point in the book you said we can only change ourselves. It's up to that person when they realize that it's time for them to make that change. Only then will they do so.
Right. And we get stuck in doing things that we think are going to make a difference. You know, we get things like arguments. You know, when somebody's doing crazy things because they're addicted and they're hurting you and they're hurting the people around you and they're spending money you don't have and pawning things in your home that you need to get back. And, of course, you know, it seems that arguing is just a natural thing that happens. But when you're talking about addiction, all of these things that naturally you do, you end up arguing, you end up calling them names, you end up so frustrated. But the truth is those things don't work. But even though they don't work, arguing doesn't work, threatening doesn't work, you get stuck in these patterns of doing it because you don't know what else to do. You just feel at your wit's end. And what I found is when I learned to change my own reactions and to change my own patterns and to walk away instead of arguing or to try to see things from a different point of view, that's when things really started to turn around and change. I mean, it took, again, about 15 years for me to learn this, but I kept doing the same things over and over again. And, you know, it's just like that saying, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome. And for those of us who get in a relationship with somebody with addiction, we do that. We get stuck in these patterns of doing the same things. And for some reason, we think that this time when we threaten or this time when we argue, it's going to make a change. And, of course, it never does. And the story, you know, that I shared about Jim and Mary, that was a friend of mine who allowed me to share her story. But, and for those who haven't read the book, she was stuck in these patterns of her husband was also had addiction, and she had two young children at the time. And, you know, one of the stories I share that she shared with me is, you know, he came home and he was high, and they had planned an evening, and they were supposed to go to the movies, and the kids were excited. And as soon as he came home in that shape, it destroyed everybody's evening. And instead of doing what maybe a lot of healthy people would do, is go on with the evening without their husband, instead the evening is ruined. And those are the kinds of things that we do over and over when you have an addict in your life. You really allow their addiction to destroy everybody's moods, everybody's plans. Everything seems to really revolve around, is that person with addiction going to be okay today? Are they clean today? Are they not? And it's like everybody is on eggshells waiting to see how is the day going to go. And the day is going to go either good or bad depending on how the addict is doing. And that's a really sad part of family addiction, is that it affects the whole family. But the truth is it's because the family doesn't know that there's healthier ways to handle it and that it can change, and that's what I learned. And that's why I wanted to really write this book, is to share the things I learned along the way that really actually, even though we cannot take addiction away from our loved ones and we can't cure it for them, we can definitely take steps that can help them to see new ways themselves. And I believe that my changes helped my husband to finally get clean.
Right. And another great point that you bring up in the book is the art of journaling, which is remembering all of the details, because sometimes when we take that back step and we look at things from the outside, looking at it in a piece of paper or if we're on film, and we go back and we look at it, that's when we become more enlightened, and we become a critic of what we could have done better, and what, and we realize what we've done wrong. So I believe that the journaling is a very important part of the beginning stages of even attempting to figure out how to start to make that change.
Absolutely. And for anybody who does do journaling, what I found too is that you really get in touch with yourself. And sometimes you're not even in touch with things until all of a sudden you find that you're writing it, and it's like a light bulb moment, and you really are able to reflect on yourself. Or there are times where you go back and you read something you wrote 6 months ago or a year ago, and it's almost like you're a different person now, because we do grow and change. And I'm a big fan of journaling because of that very reason. You really do, I think, get in touch with yourself better than it really allows you to reflect. And I encourage anybody who's not doing it to journal. I think any of us who do journal do realize what a positive thing it is. Even if, you know, and I think some people think that you have to, you know, be a good writer or love writing, but it's really just about getting in touch with yourself and kind of putting on paper whatever's going on in that moment. Then sometimes you look back and really reflect and see things much more clearly. And throughout the book, I have journaling sections at the end of each chapter to just kind of help you start that process. If you've never journaled before, or even if you have journaled, it kind of helps take what you read in that chapter and really make it more personal, so that you can really look at your own life and your own situation and reflect on those things.
Right. And I want to say welcome to all of our listeners this evening. For our listeners in the chat room, of course, if you have a question or comment for our guest this evening, who is Lisa Ann Esbich, she is the author of Soaring Above Co-Addiction, Helping Your Loved One Get Clean While Creating the Life of Your Dreams. If you have a question or comment for Lisa, feel free to type it in the chat room and I will read it for you on air. And to all of our listeners, feel free to call in if you'd like. Welcome to our listeners in our call query. Of course, our number is 646-478-4726. And if you would like to be on air, press the number 1 on your phone. That will let me know that you would like to be on air. Again, thank you for joining us here this evening. And, Lisa, one thing I want you to touch on for our listeners is the art of letting go.
That's, I think, one of the very hardest things to do. In talking to other families who are going through this, I think especially for those parents who are struggling with a child who has addiction, it's especially hard to let go because, you know, as a parent, you really do feel responsible for your child. And I think a lot of times when you are in a marriage or a relationship with somebody who has an addiction problem, in your mind you think, well, if it comes down to it, I can leave him or her, I can divorce him or her, but as a parent, that's not really an option. And so in talking to a lot of families, that's what I'm finding. Those are the ones who have the very hardest time letting go, is when it's a child. I know that for me, I think because my husband and I married so young, we really did grow up together, really. And I think letting go is, if you don't have a good sense of yourself or goals of your own, and everything really is surrounding the addict, you know, I think one of the biggest problems for those of us in a relationship with the addict is we feel somehow that our happiness is dependent on whether or not that person gets clean. And so for many years, I did not believe that I could be happy if my husband wasn't clean. And everything was sort of put on hold. And as soon as he's clean, or I can get him into treatment, or when he stops using or drinking, then everything will be perfect. And the truth is, we can't put our lives on hold because, I mean, we only have one life to live, and if we're putting our lives on hold, waiting for another person to come around or to get well, we're going to look back one day and realize that our lives have passed by us, and we put them on hold. And I know I look back, and, you know, almost 2 decades, really, I lost a lot of myself and happiness because I put my life on hold waiting for somebody to get clean. You know, I don't know that there's any easy answers on how you let go, but what I found for myself that when I started setting goals for myself, when I started looking at a future, even without my husband, what is it that I want? What is it I want from my life, even if he's not in the picture, and started moving toward that and taking steps toward that, that's when I was finally able to let go and realize that his addiction and what happens with him is really, I had to have faith that whatever was meant to be was going to happen, and that I couldn't control it. As much as I tried to control it for so many years, I had no control over it. But for me, it was a slow process that it took me a long time to accept that. Although once I started really moving toward that, it happened very quickly, and I was actually surprised at how quickly it all happened once I really made this effort to move forward. But for many of us, we get really stuck, and it's hard for us to let go and realize that there is a life that we have of our own outside of what's going on with the addiction and with the addict.
But
again, I found that for parents especially, you know, it's hard for them to accept that. But the truth is, I watched my husband's parents go through the same type of patterns that I did and trying to control the situation and not feeling like they could be happy until their son was clean. And the truth is, you know, you still, even though it's your child and you love your child more than anything in the world and you want the best for them, the things that you do to help somebody with any other sort of illness just doesn't work with addiction. And as long as we're there to make things easier, to take away their pain, to alleviate the consequences from their actions, as long as we're doing those things, then the addiction is going to continue strong. And I think especially for parents, what's really important for them to understand is they have to let their child start feeling the pain and dealing with the consequences, because as long as they take that away, they're really just helping to enable the disease and keep it strong.
And two things here. Let's backtrack a bit, because you touched on another good point, is the fact that, you know, at some point we allow this person who's addicted, whether it be alcohol or drugs or whatever, to they actually control every aspect of our lives. And I'm going back a bit to Jim and Mary when she was speaking about them having the date to go to the movies. And when he came home, he was already incapacitated. So when Mary found out, she just canceled the plans instead of going on with their evening for her and the children, and, you know, let him be there and sit in that silence and figure out that, you know, wow, they actually left without me.
Right. Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's, and for my husband, I know that when I started really, you know, taking steps, if I came home and he had been using or he had been drinking, and I would go on with whatever I was going to do without him, or I might leave the house with my son just so that we could go have a good time and not see this, I know it really started to scare him. And it was a real awakening time for him because, you know, before, he knew I was, you know, as depressed as he might be, as bad as things were, he knew that I was there with him. And that was a comfort for him. That helped him know that, well, no matter what, I was here going through it with him. And suddenly I wasn't there going through it with him, and I was moving forward in my life. And I think for any addict, when they can see that their loved ones, their family is moving forward, and they're going to have a choice. Either they're going to move forward with them, or they're going to end up, you know, in this addiction alone. But I think if you look at anybody who's had an addiction for any amount of time, there's somebody, at least one person in their life, that's helping to enable that. Whether it's a parent, whether it's a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a husband, a wife, you know, somebody's helping them keep this going. Because if everybody made it clear that, you know, you continue using and I'm not in your life anymore, things would probably progress much faster and they'd go into treatment faster or seek help faster. But somehow there's usually somebody in their life that's helping them feel okay to continue doing what they're doing. And in the case of my friend Mary, and I've done it too, I had somebody read the book recently and they couldn't understand, you know, they're reading her story and they were like, well, yeah, I mean, if he comes home acting like that, leave with the kids. I don't understand what the problem was. But I did the same thing. And I think anybody who's been in a relationship with an addict can relate to that, because even though from the outside, it's very obvious, you know, you guys have plans. Go on with your plans. Don't worry about, you know, whether he wants to destroy his evening. But as families that get stuck in this pattern of addiction, we allow it to affect the entire family. And it really does become about, everything really ends up being about what is the addict doing. And especially I think holiday time is extremely difficult, because leading up to the holidays, leading up to any big event, you know, you start worrying sometimes weeks in advance, you know, is the holiday going to get ruined? Is this event going to be ruined? Are they going to show up? Are they going to be drunk? It's a constant worrying that's going on in the family. And I think that's why they really call it a family disease, because it affects everybody in the household and everybody in the family.
Right.
And it's really, you know, that's why I think us as family members and friends and loved ones, again, even though we can't take addiction away and we can't take the steps for them, we can absolutely start taking steps that change the dynamics that can really trigger some positive changes in the addict, but especially in our own lives, because we deserve better.
And that's true. We do deserve better. And for all of our listeners, once again, tonight my special guest is Lisa Ann Espich. She is the author of Soaring Above Co-Addiction, Helping Your Loved One Get Clean While Creating the Life of Your Dreams. Of course, if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call at 646-478-4726. Or welcome to all of our guests in the chat room. You can also type your question or response, and I will read it for you on air. Thank you so much for joining us here this evening, as always. And getting back to the topic at hand, for a lot of our listeners, as I was telling you earlier, I have several friends who are dealing with this type of situation right now. Two are dealing with alcoholics. Another is dealing with someone who is both alcoholic and dealing with drugs. So, and actually it works the same for both. You have to learn how to, I guess essentially they call it the tough love syndrome, or even if you're a child and you have a parent who is a drug addict or an alcoholic, sometimes you have to know when to just say, you know what, I'm not going to allow you to keep calling me and upsetting me or controlling me, because then I'm upset and it's just not working. So, again, for all of our listeners, if you know anyone that is going through this, pick up a copy of this book, because it is chock full of good information and suggestions to help you make it through this type of situation. It is a great book. I enjoyed reading it. I wish I had it, you know, in some tumultuous points in my life, but we all learn. And, of course, if we have some type of a guideline or someone to help us along, that just makes it so much easier for us to weather this particular storm. One thing that you had also brought up was a lot of times, and I do have a friend who is not working, but as you said in the book, I believe there's certain things that she can do to get herself a hobby or start a home-based business or something to, you know, get
yourself
more interested.
I know for me, and I was home for almost 10 years, and even though the addiction started getting really bad during that time, I felt very much like a financial prisoner. I didn't see a way out because I had no finances of my own. I didn't have a college degree. I didn't have something that I had left and could go right back to. And so it felt very overwhelming, this idea of, if I leave him, what do I do? Do I go, you know, now I'm living with my parents and trying to find a job, and who's going to take care of my son? It's just all very overwhelming. I think one of the things that I could have done and I didn't do is there are so many home-based businesses that you can look into and start up, even if it's just getting a little bit of financial independence of your own. You know, during that time for me, I didn't even have $5 of my own. My husband took care of the bank account. He knew what was in the bank. I didn't know what was in the bank. And so I really allowed myself to get stuck in this prison, financial prison, where I felt helpless of, what do I do? How do I get out of this? I would encourage anybody who might be in that same type of situation and feel like they can't get out of the situation because of finances, look for something that might be able to even gain you a little bit of financial freedom, even if just for your own confidence. To suddenly, I know that for me, when I finally started working, to make your own paycheck was just such a boost of confidence. My self-esteem went way up just because I just felt like somebody was acknowledging what I did and I was getting my own paycheck. It was so exciting. And, you know, I think even then, if I had babysat kids and put that money away for myself, or, I mean, there's so many things that you could do. You know, just think about what you're good at. Maybe you're good at cooking and you can start catering some events, or maybe you're good with animals and you can start training pets. I mean, there's really so many things. And so I did mention that in the book, that would be one great way to just start taking steps toward that financial freedom. And I think, you know, a lot of times, I know that when I was deep in the middle of this, people on the outside who maybe found out what was going on, you know, the first reaction from friends and family members a lot of times is, well, just get yourself out of the situation. Leave the bum. You know, these comments that, you know, the truth is most of us are still in a relationship because there is part of that person that we know is a wonderful person and we love, and we really want them to get well. And so we keep hoping that we can help them get well. But, you know, I think it's just difficult because from the outside, there's not always a good understanding of what is going on inside of you and why you can't seem to leave that situation. Even though I've never been in an abusive relationship, I can understand now, being through this, why somebody stays in an abusive relationship, because you kind of go through the same type of thing. You lose a little bit of yourself. You don't feel like you can leave this person. You believe this person has it in them to get better and to be good, and so you hang on to that. One of the reasons I really wanted to write the book was really also to just have somebody else share what was going on in their lives and feel like somebody else understands and found some ways to help. I know when I was reading a lot of books, a lot of them are written by doctors and counselors, and they were very helpful, and there were some wonderful books out there, but I always felt somehow they were a little detached from what I really felt inside, and I wanted to be able to share from a perspective of somebody who's been there and knows what it's like to be in the middle of that relationship and not find a way to get out. But, yeah, I think definitely just taking even little steps. It doesn't mean that you have to leave the relationship today, tomorrow, next week, and that's what your friends and family a lot of time are wanting you to just leave, and you're not ready for that maybe. But if you just take little steps to put yourself in that direction, you'll find that little by little you're getting stronger and going a little further and getting more confident, and then you can make some healthy choices for yourself. Sometimes right now we're not in a position to make the healthiest choices for ourselves.
Right. And, when this show is over, I'm going to download it myself and give it to a friend on CD because, again, I told you, you have touched on so many things that I think that this particular individual that I know needs to hear. And one of the things that I had prepared her for was the fact that when she found her voice, her husband would then, you know, he'd go through these phases. And one of those phases, which, again, we'll be speaking about in a minute, is when all of a sudden then he wants to notice her. He hasn't noticed her in 11 years. And now that she's found her voice and she's not his footstool anymore, and she's learning how to live and not allow him to control her actual, you know, her very existence. Right now, he's going through that paranoid phase. And I know,
yeah.
I believe it's on page 37, you had written about the fact that once they start to witness the change in their spouse, when they start to see that they no longer have that control anymore, they really start to get a little bit worried.
Oh, yeah. And I think, too, what can happen, and I saw it happen with my husband, is that as they see you getting strong and taking on this new confidence that maybe you didn't have before, a lot of times they may do or say things to try and kick you back to where you were. You know, it's kind of, they get afraid. And so, you know, and I think that's where things can cross over to. Like I said, my husband was never physically abusive, but I can definitely say he was verbally abusive. And that's really where some of the verbal abuse really entered in. And that was, I think, more him trying to put me back to where I was because he saw me getting strong and moving forward, and he didn't want me moving in that direction without him. And so that it can be a rough time, a rough transition stage, because as you're getting strong, they're gonna get paranoid or scared or try and bring you back. He would fall into very deep depression, and in the past, I would get depressed right along with him, and it was a very odd feeling when it got to a point where he would be in depression, and I definitely felt for him, and I felt sorry for him, and I wanted him to feel good, yet I wasn't depressed anymore. And it's an odd feeling when suddenly you realize, wow, I'm happy inside. I'm excited about the future. I'm having fun, and part of you feels like, well, this isn't right because my husband is here and he's deep in this addiction and depressed, why should I be feeling good? But there comes a point when you realize that you deserve to feel good in your life. I realized that I had been through enough years of being depressed and taking on his emotions, and but at the same time, like I said, it was very odd. It was very odd to feel good for the first time in a long time, even though things hadn't changed with my husband. And it scared me. It really actually scared me that, because it was this new direction, a new phase of my life that I had to even get used to. But definitely I knew that I inside had changed. I wasn't the same person anymore. And that's really when, and I share in the book how much affirmations and visualization and meditation and prayer and these things, really when I embraced them, I couldn't even believe how quickly everything really started to turn around in my life, even though nothing had changed with my husband. And it was actually incredible to see my own transformation so quickly.
I wanted to touch on something else too, because a lot of times, and I think this goes back to the journaling part as well, is that we need to actually sit down and try to find or write down the ways that, in hindsight, I guess we could say, that we're actually enabling these individuals to continue their behavior. Because a lot of times we feel as though we don't realize that we are feeding into and helping them to continue to do what they do, which, of course, does not give them any type of incentive to want to get better. And
no.
I believe that, you know, that in itself is a very important point to make, is that we need to understand that sometimes we are actually allowing them and helping them to continue in their negative and unhealthy behaviors.
Right. And you touched on, you know, you mentioned tough love, and that's really what tough love is all about. But I really, in my own experience, found that tough love many times was a lot tougher on me than it was on him, because I think a lot of the enabling we sometimes do is actually to benefit ourselves as well. For example, you don't want everybody in your life to know that this is going on. It feels very embarrassing. It becomes a secret, and you don't want the secret out yourself. And so a lot of the enabling I did and covering up for my husband was to somehow protect myself and keep the secret, because I didn't want the whole world to know what was going on behind closed doors, because I felt ashamed about it. And, you know, there's a lot of things that I think we do. For example, calling in, you know, if my husband had been hungover and couldn't go to work and I call in sick for him, you know, really that's to benefit me too, because if he loses his job, where does that leave us? And so I was doing a lot of these things that enabled his addiction, and part of it was really to benefit me too. And I realized that I had to take some of, you know, some of it hurt me when I finally wouldn't call work for him, or I finally wouldn't clean up a mess. And so I would have to look at a mess until he cleaned it up. And, you know, it's a very hard thing to stop enabling and to start having that tough love mentality, because it's really not easy. It's not that you're just laying everything on the addict and making them face all their consequences. You're kind of having to deal with some of it too, and it's very hard. And I found it a difficult thing to, you know, stop hiding things for him, stop keeping a secret, stop helping him get out of these situations, because in reality, you know, it was a tough thing for me to have to go through too. But I knew that if I didn't start doing those things and stop enabling, then it was just going to go on forever. You know, and just things like my husband used to come home and, you know, if he had been drinking, we'd get upset, and I write about it in the book. And he did this I don't know how many times. It became this habit of we'd be arguing and he'd kick the garbage across the kitchen floor. And, you know, it would have been right after I made dinner and stuff would fly everywhere, and then he'd leave the house. And at least 5 or 6 times this happened, and I would then clean up the whole mess. And when he finally came home, there was no mess there. He probably didn't even remember what he did half the time. And when I started to take on these new healthy patterns, he did it again. And that time I went to bed without cleaning it up, and I just left the mess there. And I really, it was a scary thing, because I didn't know, you know, how is he going to react and what's going to happen when he sees this. And the next morning I woke up and the kitchen was clean, and he never did it again. And had I not finally, you know, made a clear boundary and said, no, I'm not going to clean up your mess for you, it probably would have kept going on over and over and again. And it was little things like that that I realized, wow, if I stop doing these things for him, he's going to see what he's doing and make some positive changes of his own. And like I said, that never happened again. You know, how many times does a loved one pick up their addicted partner from the floor after they've passed out and get them in bed, and, you know, when they wake up, they don't even realize they had passed out on the floor. But if we leave them on the floor so that they wake up in the middle of the night and find themselves laying on the floor passed out, you know, those are the things that they need to start realizing how bad things are getting without us constantly telling them, this is what you did, this is how bad things have gotten. Let them actually deal with some of the consequences and see how bad things have gotten. But I found, too, as a parent, it was difficult because, you know, if you have children around, you're wanting to clean things up because you don't want the children to see it. So that poses a whole other problem because you're trying to hide things from your own children. And with my son, you know, there came a time where I really had to just start talking to him about the things that were going on. And, you know, he understood at a pretty early age that his father had an addiction, and that's why he did some of the things he did. But when we're constantly trying to hide, not only from the outsiders, from our own children, we're trying to constantly hide things, that's where a lot of the enabling comes in, because you're trying to keep this all secretive. You don't want it to really get out.
And I always say that that's when you're continuously wearing the mask, and for whatever reason, a lot of times I found that people would be surprised that wearing the mask is only for, I guess, our benefit, because really, a lot of times people on the outside looking in have already figured out that there was something very wrong, if not exactly what is going on. So I guess that brings to the point where you use the analogy that, you know, we get used to living reactively as opposed to, in my words, responsibly. So, you know, we react to things instead of responding to things, and most people don't realize that there's a big difference between reacting to something and responding to something.
Absolutely. Yeah, because when you're living reactively, it really is like you're just waiting what's going to happen so you can react to it, rather than having a clear plan and moving forward in a healthy way. You're just waiting to see, you know, what this other person's going to do, so that you know whether, you know, how you can react. It's really a terrible way to be living your life. And I think a lot of times we're doing it because we're somehow thinking that we're keeping our own lives in control, or we're keeping that, you know. And I think you kind of touched on it right there a few minutes ago, when we think that we're keeping this all a secret, when the reality is people outside usually know that there's something wrong. And, you know, for me, I have a twin sister who's my best friend in the world, and I kept this all very secret from her. She knew that there were problems, but she didn't know how deep the problems were. She didn't know that my husband was using the drugs that he was using. And when I think back, I don't know why we get into this fear of sharing with the people who are closest to us. And, you know, we are cutting them off from our lives. And the truth is, they want to be there to help you and to be a shoulder and to help give you guidance or support. And I found that I had really shut out the closest people to me to try and keep this hidden. And when I think back, that's a very sad thing, because I really, during those years, hurt those close relationships that, you know, if you have a friend, I know that if I had my sister was going through this, I would have wanted to be there for her. And I don't know why we shut ourselves off like we do, but it seems to be a part of the pattern of a family addiction, that we create this secretive world, and we think we're keeping it all a secret, and we want to keep the secret. We don't want everyone to find out. I think part of it is we know that if they find out, we're going to be forced to face it and make changes. And again, sometimes as bad as things are, it's less scary than the unknown. So if we have to make a change, we don't know what exactly that's going to mean for our future. you get to a point where you believe, well, I can live with this. I've been living with it. If I leave him or if I make this change, I don't know what that's going to mean for the future. And the unknown is very scary, and it keeps us stuck sometimes.
That's true. And to just expand on that a little bit, sometimes, well, two things. Sometimes we come from families where, you know, all of this is, it's taboo to take any of this, your problems outside of the home. Everything is supposed to be inside. You keep the secrets and the deceptions and sometimes the lies or whatever. They all stay within this family. You do not open the door, go outside, or, you know, throw the curtains back and let anyone on the outside get any inkling of what's going on within these closed doors. So that's another problem in itself. And then sometimes I found, you know, in doing healing through hurt and, of course, and just talking to people in general, that sometimes when we try to open up to people naturally, you know, there's something to be said for that adage, I'll walk a mile in my shoes, because most people have all the answers in the world, have never experienced the issue for themselves. But they can tell you, oh, you need to do this, or I would do this, and blah, 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 until it happens to them. And then,
absolutely. Yeah, it's really easy on the outside to say, oh, you need to just leave, or I would never put up with that. And I think for many of us, our boundaries keep going further and further out. So where maybe in the early years of my marriage, there were things that happened later on that I never would have believed I'd put up with, but somehow your boundaries keep going further and further. So it's, well, if he was to do this, then I would leave him. But then they cross that boundary, and now your boundary goes further. Well, if he was to do this, then I'll leave him. And your own boundaries just keep getting further until finally you find yourself in these situations that you never in a million years believed that you would be in. And you're right. I think other people who haven't maybe been in your shoes can look from the outside and very easily think, oh, God, I would never put up with that. But it's something that just, I think, more gradually happens, and your boundaries start to get broken down, and you just start, you know, pushing yourself into situations even further and further than you ever believed you would. And so you're right. That's why a lot of times we don't share, because we know that, and we don't want to be judged. And certainly for anybody who, you know, even saying the words, my husband is addicted to crack cocaine, I mean, just saying those words are like the most difficult words to say, because there's such a stigma. And with addiction, there's this a real shame and stigma that you don't want, you know, I'm at work, you know, through the years I was getting promoted and I, you know, have a great position that nobody around me would have ever known that I was leaving this position at work and going home to a husband who was addicted to crack cocaine. And even the thought that they would find out, you know, it just caused me this terrible feeling of shame, like I would never want anyone to know. And that's what I think keeps us stuck so often when it comes to addiction. And probably with, you know, abuse or anything in that realm, it's this stigma that, you know, for me it's like I'm thinking, well, if people I work with know that I'm married to somebody who is a drug addict, well, does that mean that you do drugs? And there's all this, you know, this thing that keeps you keeping it secret. But as long as you keep it secret, you seem to be working more to help keep it a secret than moving forward. And, you know, even just writing this book and being able to write about it, I was in the process of writing the book, not really knowing if it was ever going to be published or be out there. I just was writing the book, hoping that it could help somebody one day. But even coming out with the book and sharing with some of the, you know, the people I work with what the book is about, it's a scary step, because there is a real stigma around it, especially when you're talking about the type of drug that my husband was addicted to. And you don't want to be judged. None of us want to be judged.
Yeah, that's just so true. And, again, sometimes I guess that can lead us into our next subject, is the fact that you know, we don't want to be judged, and then sometimes we're our own worst judge, jury, and executioner for ourselves, which leads me up to our next topic, which is learning how to forgive ourselves and to make that conscious decision that, you know, next time we're going to, you know, handle the situation in a better way or a healthier way to, you know, move forward. And again, that's a vital part of moving forward, is that we need to learn how to forgive ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, because you do, and, you know, I found that I would promise myself, you know, the next time he does this, I'm leaving. You know, I would promise myself I wasn't going to deal with it anymore. And then, of course, that time would come, and I wouldn't feel the strength to do that, and I would beat myself up. And, you know, you do have to realize that, you know, this is something that has taken time for you to get kind of stuck in the middle of, and you formed patterns that, just like the addict themselves has to start taking steps toward healing, you've got to start taking steps, and it might be really baby steps. It might be that you get through the first 5 minutes without arguing, and then you start arguing, but maybe next time you get through 10 minutes and you don't get in on the arguing. So it's just, sometimes you have to, you're right, really reward yourself for the little steps that you see yourself making progress. Because when I started getting myself out of the patterns that I was in, and a lot of it was arguing, I would get, you know, I would start an argument with my husband when he had been using, even though I knew and I had learned arguments don't do anything. If anything, they make it worse, because they make them feel they have a right to go out and use more because of the argument. So I knew that arguing wasn't working, and that was one of the hardest things that for me was to stop the arguing. It was exactly that. I had to realize, okay, this time I got through a whole hour and I didn't argue, but then I lost it. But I had to learn to realize that I'd made progress, and that next time maybe I could really just leave the house or whatever it is. But I think also forgiving the addict themselves is another big one, that that how do you, you know, find a way to forgive them as well. I know that for my husband, when he finally did go into treatment, you know, there were a lot of things he did that people would think are unforgivable. And I actually was at a book event a week ago, and one of the ladies in the audience asked me, how did you find a way to get over the resentment and forgive him? And that, I think, is a hard part for a lot of people. You know, for my husband, you know, I would come home, he would have pawned my son's video game equipment. I would have to go get it out of the pawn shop. When I did finally leave him and left him for a whole month, you know, he had sold and traded everything that was in the house. He traded every piece of furniture, everything from our washer and dryer. I mean, when he finally went into treatment, there was a mattress on the living room floor, and that was it. Everything was gone. And a lot of people would think, well, how do you get past that? You know, your whole life got traded away for drugs. For me, through my own healing, I also did a lot of reading and studying about addiction, and so that I can understand what was going on with my husband. And I found that through the learning about addiction and understanding what happens to the brain, and that they really are doing these things because, I mean, there's literally like brain damage that has happened. The chemicals in the brain are completely confused, and their brain gets hijacked. And so everything that they're doing is really for the drug. And the more I learned about addiction and understood it, that's really how I was able to just really forgive everything that he had done, because I knew that he was living for a drug, and I finally was able to understand why he would do the things that he did. And after he went into treatment and got clean, you know, he truly came back the man that I knew he was and the man that I first fell in love with. And so that made it easier, too, because, you know, he's a wonderful, loving man. But I was very easily able to forgive him because of understanding it. And I would encourage anyone going through this to please read what you can and understand addiction, because it's very difficult to help another person with a problem if you don't understand the problem and you don't understand why they're doing the things they're doing. And that was a big part for me, is once I understood addiction, it was so much easier for me to make better choices and to forgive him and to forgive myself, because it was all, you learn so much. And one of the best books I read about that I would encourage anybody to get is, it's based on an HBO documentary series. It's called Why Can't They Just Stop? And there's also a website. But it taught me so much about addiction, actually understanding what happens to the brain. And I think it's really important for anybody dealing with this to understand it, because otherwise you just if you don't understand it, it's hard to make healthy changes.
Right, and one of the things that I always say, like one of my part of my daily mantras, is that I don't like to be a victim, and I believe you had wrote something in reference to that in the book about whenever we might make 4 steps forwards and then we'll take 5 steps backwards, and we'll start to feel like we're right back into that victim role again. And that's when we really do need to have that, you know, reality check to bring us back on point, because once we fall back into that mode of being a victim, you know, it just stifles our movement forward, and we can't go anywhere if we feel that way. You know, you can either be a survivor or a victim. And a lot of times,
Yeah, and you're right. That's with everything in our lives, too. I mean, I know that all of us probably have people in our lives who feel like they're always the victim and everything is everyone else's fault.
Exactly.
And the truth is, I mean, when I look back at, yes, I felt very helpless and I felt like a victim in all of this, but in reality, I was able to very easily, once I knew the steps to take, I was able to get myself out of that victim role. And the truth was, I was the one who kept myself stuck there. My husband, you know, I think one of the things I wrote about was I shared how, you know, toward the end of the book, I shared that I wanted to go out to a hot air balloon site with the person I was working with. And you know, it was on a weekend, and I always spent my weekends with my family, and I knew that if I brought this up to Dean, you know, I was just sure it was going to start an argument, and I didn't feel like I could just make these decisions that I wanted to go do this on the weekend by myself. But the truth is, when I told him, he could care less, and I had built up this thing in my mind like it was going to be a big problem, and in reality, it wasn't, but you know, I think we put ourselves into that victim role. We put ourselves into the situation of thinking that we're stuck. And not, I mean, all of us are in control of our lives. We just have to, I guess we have to learn to realize it, and that nobody else is controlling our lives.
And with that said, we have about 56 minutes left in the show. I told you it would go quickly. We're going to take a small break, and when we come back, we're going to pick up with Lisa, and we're going to start talking about all of the positive end of this, and we're going to start working on coming towards that goal where we're healing ourselves as well as helping our loved ones heal as well. We will be right back in about 1 minute.
Welcome to Healing Through Hurt, Talk Radio's Sunday morning meditation. I'm your host, Maria Wall. I welcome you to join me for just 15 minutes of simple stress relief. Leave what happened last week in the past, and do not allow what may be coming your way to disturb your moment of peace right now. Again, I'd like to welcome you to Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio's Sunday morning meditation. Join me for the next 15 minutes as we experience meditation and stress-relieving exercises.
Okay, we are back. Of course, that was our promo for our Sunday morning meditation show. Join us here each Sunday morning at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time for our 15 minutes of stress relief and release. And speaking of relief and release, we are here with Ms. Lisa Ann Essich. She is the author of Soaring Above Co-Addiction, Helping Your Loved Ones Get Clean While Creating the Life of Your Dreams. And we have been talking about living with someone who you love or care about who is suffering from some type of an addiction, whether it be alcohol, drugs, or whatever. She has been sharing with us ways that you can create that life for yourself and break this vicious cycle of enabling your loved one to continue in their negative and unhealthy behavior. And we're about to start on the upside of things now because we have about 53 minutes left in the show. And, Lisa, two things right now. Could you tell people how they can get a copy of your book?
Yes, it's available anywhere books are sold, but you can go to my website at soaringabovecoaddiction.com, and as well as it's available Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Borders.com, and it's also available on ebook as well, on all ebook formats.
And, of course, once again, I always have some of my loyal listeners. They always want to know if it's available on Kindle.
Oh, yes. It's on Kindle, Nook, any of the ebook reader formats. It's on all of them.
Great. Well, that took care of one question that I got for this week.
Yes.
We're going to talk about the real beginning of the healing process now, so we can start where the listeners and people who they may know that are going through this, they need to learn how to start taking care of themselves. And I love the part in the book where you said, make pretend, go into the kitchen and make pretend like you're a chef, or, you know, just give us some ideas of how to enjoy learning how to begin to take care of ourselves.
Yeah. You know, I think for myself, when I think back, there were a lot of years where I, not only did I lose myself, but there was really no joy in my life. I was depressed and angry and feeling hopeless. And as I started to make a plan for getting in touch with myself and moving forward and making a life again, you know, one of the things that I found is just learning what's fun. I think we forget what is even fun anymore. There's no fun in our lives. And as a child, I always had a huge imagination. And, you know, just sort of getting in touch with having fun again. I would go into the kitchen and, yeah, pretend you're a chef and whip something up big and enjoy doing simple things again, even just setting a table and having a nice meal. And, you know, there are so many simple things that can bring so much joy to your life, and we forget to look at that. You know, we get so caught up in all of this negative stuff that's going on that we forget to appreciate even the simplest things. And I found that I was able to finally be grateful for the things that I did have in my life that I wasn't paying attention to. I mean, even just having a roof over your head, not being homeless, having a vehicle to get in and drive, and just going for a long drive on a weekend, anything that you could find fun again. And I think if we all look back at if you're not having fun in your life right now, what did you used to have fun doing? And chances are you'd still have fun doing it. You know, even just cleaning out a closet and suddenly you're, you know, trying on clothes and then trying on makeup. And I can remember as a teenager, I loved, like, you know, doing my hair crazy and putting on makeup and having the music blast. And I found I still enjoyed doing that. It was still fun. And, you know, just because we're grown-ups doesn't mean we can't enjoy and have fun in our lives. And my sister and I, as I started building my relationship back up with my sister and having fun in my life again, you know, we would go out and, you know, we would have a spa day where we would just do each other's nails and you know, even just going and doing exercise together. There's so many things. Going out for a bike ride, swinging on a swing set. I forgot I did that just not too long ago, and you forget how fun just swinging on a swing set is. There's all these things that are just fun to do.
And it's so true because, you know, a lot of times I sit on the phone with my daughter-in-law and we talk for hours at a time, and sometimes we're not saying too much of anything. Then we'll just burst into laughter for whatever reason. It's just sometimes we're just acting silly. And it's a tension reliever. It's just fun to just laugh and let go and be silly sometime and enjoy doing the things that we've forgotten how to do. And I know so many people who don't find anything in this world funny. I mean, absolutely nothing. I don't know what you all see funny. I don't get it. I don't feel the joy. You know, they're just so negative. And, you know, I try to keep this ray of light around me to keep that negativity away, because with everything going on in the world now, it's so much negativity and mean and nastiness going on. We have to do things so that we don't fall into that trap as well, because right about now, it's growing at a pace where this negativity is just consuming. It seems like it's a cloud over the entire planet right now. And, you know, there's just no happiness anywhere. People don't smile anymore. They're mean. They're cruel. You know, it's almost amazing at this point. But
Well, and we do all have, there's no doubt we each have an energy around us and in us. And, I mean, we've all had a situation where somebody, just even being around them, is a downer or makes you feel, you know, depressed as soon as you're around them or negative as soon as you're around them. And I don't think any of us wants to be that person. I mean, you want to be the person that has this positive energy. And if you don't help create that positive energy around you and find joy, I really have learned and believe in the power of manifesting, and a lot of that is all about your own energy. And if you're walking around depressed and negative and angry, it's going to be very difficult to attract anything positive into your life, because, you know, you're surrounded with this negative energy. And even if you're surrounded by a negative energy right now, you can change it, because when I think back, for years, I was depressed and unhappy and angry, and I was able to finally release that and change my own energy. So it's not, I don't think that people are stuck with it. You can change it. You just have to realize that you have to change it and take steps toward that. But, yeah, I mean, having fun and laughing, what's better than laughter?
This is true. And my thing is, again, you know, I love being by myself because I'm not lonely. I love being alone. But in the same breath, I know what it's like to be isolated or to have been in situations where you feel isolated, which is what being in this type of relationship can do to you, is make you feel isolated. So at some point, you know, you need to get back in touch with friends and family that you have not spoken to, or for those of us out here who don't have any friends, you know, some people say they don't have friends, you know, go out and make some. It may help a little bit if you had some friends. maybe one
absolutely.
Or two for starters.
And if you have nobody to turn to, and even if you have people to turn to, there's so many groups out there with people who are in the same situation. When you look at 12-step programs, Al-Anon, those are all groups that you may not know another person in your whole city. You may feel like you really are completely alone, and you can walk into one of those groups, and you'll be welcomed with open arms and, you know, maybe build some of the best, most positive friendships that you'll ever have. But what you just said about feeling so isolated, it really made me think of a time. It makes me very sad to think of it, because when my husband was really deep into his addiction, I remember leaving the house one night, and I had to get away from him. He, you know, everything was out of control, and I got in my car and I started driving. And now I live in a city with 6 or 7 different family members. All of my family is close to me. Yet I drove to the middle of a parking lot, and I remember just sitting there and bawling and feeling like I had nowhere to go and no one to turn to, because everything had been kept so secret. So I didn't feel like I could just walk to one of their doorsteps. And I literally slept in my car in that parking lot, feeling more isolated than I had ever felt in my life. Yet I was surrounded in a city of people who knew me and loved me. And that's, I think, what, you know, is a good picture of what happens to family members, that they isolate themselves. My family would have hated thinking that I was in a car crying by myself, feeling alone, when they were right down the street, but I couldn't bring myself to go to them. And that's sad.
Right, and you know, I always used to have people think about this. You're in a world of billions of people, and yet you feel as though you're absolutely alone. And
yeah.
That is one of the absolute worst feelings in the world, to wake up each and every day in this world full of people, different personalities, different ethnicities, different ethnic origins, all types of people, and you feel as though you're actually in this world by yourself. I understand that. That's a feel that words can't describe it.
Really?
It's
the most lonely feeling, and
yeah.
Why we do that to ourselves mentally, that we don't think we can reach out to other people. It's really sad, and I think about anybody else who puts themselves into that situation, and I just want to, you know, be able to say you can turn to the people who love you, and please do, because they don't want you to be alone. They don't want you to not turn to them, and I think, again, we get caught up in the shame of addiction or the shame of whatever our situation is, and we need to learn to turn to those people who do care about us, because they can help lift us up, and they can help, and they want to be there for us. So we just have to learn to reach out for that help and accept that help and be receptive to it.
Right. And another thing is that many of us realize that so many of us are used to our everyday routine. We do the same thing the same way every day. We get the same type of coffee. We get the same size of coffee. We get the same donut. We go to work. We park in the same parking space. We get upset if it's not the same parking space and someone has taken up the one that we're used to. And, you know, I always say go out of the yard, open the gate, go out the gate, go down the walkway, go around the front, you know, go down the street, see what's on the next block over, you know.
Yeah.
People don't like to change for whatever reason. You know, people feel as though their routine is safe. Some people are afraid to make the change, you know, but change is good because, you know, there's no proof that we keep coming back here. And I personally think that the world is an interesting place. I love just exploring the world, exploring people. I love to meet new people. That is so why I enjoy doing Healing Through Hurt. Not only because, you know, guests such as yourself, you're helping a lot of people out here. You know, so many people come back and listen to your show. but it's the fact that I met you. And, you know, it's so funny that so many of my guests, we usually end up being friends on Facebook and Twitter or wherever. It is just so much fun, and I enjoy meeting people because each and every week I'm learning something new, and I enjoy that. And it's
and you're right,
so funny
that stuck in their comfort zone, and they don't want to go out of it.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
It is sad because we really do only have this one life to live, and I don't think any of us wants to look back on our life and, you know, realize that we didn't take any chances or have, you know, any adventures or fun. That we just it's good to be comfortable, but I think when we get too comfortable, it's time to force ourselves to make a little bit of a change so that we're living and feeling life.
Right. Right. And, I have to say it is so funny that my daughter-in-law called me early, and she has been, you know, a little bit of an introvert. And today she called me because she said she had gone out to go shopping for a particular item, and she started talking to a worker in the store that she was in. And they talked for the longest time, which is so not her. And she said she had to call me and tell me about this because, and I did, I just burst into laughter because, you know, it's so amazing, the power of reaching out and going outside of your comfort zone. You never know who you're going to come across and meet. So a lot of times for our listeners, I think that sometimes you can get help from a stranger. You know,
oh, yeah.
It may not be someone who you're used to knowing. It could be that someone makes your day who's an absolute stranger who you just happen to have, you know, struck up a conversation with. So it's okay to humble yourself, I guess we could say, and look for help in any way that you can. Because each time I do the show, I'm getting help in some way in my life, whether it be I can take what you're telling me, and like I said, I'm going to download this show and give it to a friend who's going through something, because I believe that this show is exactly what she needs to hear. And
right.
For all of our listeners, you know, make no mistake, what we're talking about this evening can apply if you are the male who's going through it and you have a female partner who's addictive to whatever, whether it be alcohol, whether it be drugs, it doesn't matter. It goes both ways. So this can work either way. This is not strictly for women who have men who are in some type of an addiction. It's also for men who have women who are in some type of addiction, or your significant other, whomever he or she is, or your
Absolutely.
Child.
Absolutely, and I men probably even have a harder time reaching out for help, because as women, I think just by nature, we're maybe more willing to accept that help. But I think men probably have an even extra challenge because they're supposed to be that strong rock and not admit that there's problems
right.
or weakness. And so absolutely, I think for men especially, to be able to reach out and look for help and to accept support, because I'm sure
yeah.
that men going through this have that extra challenge.
Right. And, you know, and moving along with more positive energy, because now we're winding down the show. We have about 36 minutes left. Welcome to all of our guests in the chat room. If you have a question or comment for our guest this evening, who's Lisa Ann Espert. She is the author of Soaring Above Co-Addiction, Helping Your Loved One Get Clean While Creating the Life of Your Dreams. If you have a question or comment, feel free to type it in the chat room, and I will be more than happy to read it for you on air. And, of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our number is 646-478-4726. Press the number 1 on your phone, and I will bring you on air. One of the great things that I liked in your book was, you know, I know that you had said that you enjoyed the Sunday morning meditation, and one of the things that I say on there is always look in the mirror and tell yourself that you're special and you're wonderful. And in the book I saw, I said, okay, we're on the same page here.
Yeah.
You wrote about writing a love letter to yourself.
Yeah, in fact, the first time I did that, and I wrote the love letter to myself, and when I went back and read it, it really made me just so emotional. But, you know, I think we forget to give ourselves that love. You know, we always think we're going to find that love outside of ourselves. And the
right.
truth is nobody can love or fill any void inside of you. Only you can do that. And if you're filling a void inside or you're feeling alone, really it's about finding that within yourself. And we need to love ourselves. And I love, you know, that idea of writing yourself a love letter. And I know that when I did it, I found it to be a very emotional, touching thing. It really made me feel loved.
Right. And I think that once you get to that point where you can tell yourself and accept the fact that you love yourself, then, you know, that's when I think that we can look within and we can find whatever it is within us that we need and harness it to give us that strength so that we can keep, you know, putting on that armor, as I say, and be ready to call to action, that call to action, so to speak, where we're ready to fight the good fight and do what we need to do to find that happiness and to help our partners get to where they need to be.
Absolutely. And I found that after I had been going through these positive changes and building up my self-esteem and getting in touch with my inner self, there was a new armor. And not to say that I was closing myself off from anyone. It's not that type of armor. It was more of a armor of strength. And when I finally found the courage to leave my husband and refuse to come back until he got clean, he tested me more than I'd ever been tested. And things that would have caused me to come back or to weaken before, I suddenly did have, like you say, an armor that it didn't matter what he threw at me or how hard it was, I had this new strength, this armor that wasn't going to break down. And that really is an inner strength that builds that. And when you can start building your inner strength so that nothing from the outside can get in and harm you, it's just such an empowering feeling.
Oh, my goodness. It is. It is. And, you know, once again, another positive inspiration to continue on this positive journey forward is meditation, which you spoke about. And I think that meditation comes in many forms, people. For me, you know, every night after the show, I'm so pumped up and I'm so excited. And depending on what the show is, it could be a show that's very draining and things like that. So that's when I go to my quiet place. I light my candles, you know, I run a hot bath, and it's relaxing for me to sit back and just reflect and take care of me for that moment. And if I feel like putting on the soothing music or even doing some my mantras and my chants or whatever, or hums, whatever works for you, I think that meditation helps to cleanse your soul and your body of all of that negativity, and it helps you to find clarity.
Absolutely. And there's so many, like you said, there's not one right or wrong way to meditate. And I know a lot of books I've read on meditation, they're very specific in how to go about meditating, and those are good too. But for myself, I like to sort of find my own way, like you, you know, saying that even a bath is a form of meditation. And it is anything that allows you to just reflect and get in touch with yourself and relax and clear your mind, because that's really what meditation is about, is clearing your mind. I have to laugh because you had emailed me one day, and you had mentioned it's 3 a.m. in the morning, and I thought, I could imagine you get off these shows, and late at night you're still sort of wired because, you know, because here it is 3 a.m. in the morning, and you're still up. But, yeah, you're right that meditation is such an important thing. I'd like to mention anybody who's never tried meditating, or even if you have, I love guided meditation as well. And I actually, on my website, soaringabovecoaddiction.com, on my homepage, there is a free download for a guided meditation. And it's about 15 minutes long, so it's a pretty long guided meditation, but I encourage anyone to go on and download that and give it a try.
I'm going to put that in the chat room as well. And tell us a little bit about the art of writing down your dreams.
You know, I found that this was a hard practice to get into, but it was one of the most enlightening things I've done. And, you know, it's really hard when you wake up, especially if you wake up to an alarm clock or you get up right away and go to work. I have a hard time remembering my dreams on the days that I get up and go to work because of the alarm clock. But on the mornings that I don't wake up to an alarm clock, I have a much easier time remembering my dreams. But what I found is when I started paying attention to my dreams and when I first wake up, really stop and think about it, because it only takes a matter of seconds before you've lost it. And really think about it. And I keep a notepad and pen by my bed. And if there's anything that really rings a bell or I remember, I just jot it down. And I don't worry about reflecting on it right at that moment. But what I did find is the more I focused on remembering my dreams, the more clear my dreams became, almost as if my dreams or my subconscious realized I was paying attention finally. And once I started really paying attention, they became clearer, and clear signals started to come into my dreams. I had one dream that was just extremely, it was an epiphany dream is what they call it. But in this dream I had, it was right as I was starting to get healthy and on this track of visualizing and paying attention to my dreams and meditating and getting strong. And I had this dream that my husband, I woke up and he was outside using a saw, and I didn't know what he was doing. I went outside, and I found that he had a dead woman on the saw, and he was literally cutting her up. And in the dream, I panicked and realized what had happened, and a neighbor looked over the fence, and I realized that the neighbor was going to call the police. And in the dream, I had this fear that the whole world was going to know that my husband had killed this woman. And I proceeded to help him bury the remains, and as I did, all of these other remains of women came to the surface. And eventually in the dream, the police came, gave me a truth serum, which got me to tell the truth, and I felt this huge sense of relief. And I woke up, and this dream was so clear and so real, and I couldn't even talk to my husband for a day or so. I was so sickened by this dream and upset, but I wrote everything down, and I really reflected on it. And it was so enlightening because I was able to see that in this dream, I was helping my husband cover up what he had done, which is what I was doing in real life. I didn't want the world to know. And I feel that all of these women in the dream represented me and all the times that he had killed me inside and hurt me. And it was really that dream that made me realize that telling the truth was like such a release in the dream that it helped me to take a next step. And I actually ended up calling my family and telling them the truth. And that's how much of an epiphany that dream was. But that's just an example of when you really pay attention to your dreams and try to at least figure out what they mean in your life, you can actually come up with some clear answers and some insight and use it as a tool for guidance, because it really is, there's a reason we dream, and it really is your inner self trying to tell you things, trying to help you clarify things or even help resolve problems. I've even found if I ask myself, you know, through a dream to help me solve a problem, a lot of times I can wake up and actually look at what I dreamed and help me, you know, I actually did get some answers. And so I think we lose sight of how powerful dreams really are. I think we take it for granted. They're just something that happens when we're sleeping. But when you really start to pay attention, you can find that your dreams actually are an unbelievable tool to help you and guide you.
Right, because I had learned a while ago that dreams are actually your subconscious or your mind's way of telling you something. And, you know, we need to take more thought into it and try to decipher what the dreams really mean.
And as I said, if you notice, you will notice, I guarantee if you start paying closer attention to your dreams, they will become more vivid and more clear. It's almost as if all of a sudden your subconscious realizes that you're paying attention finally, and it'll start really being more clear for you. At least it did for me, but I would bet it's going to work for anyone. When you start paying attention, suddenly they're just more clear. It's fun too. I mean, you know, to wake up and try and figure out and decipher your dreams, you know, it's almost like a puzzle. And when you figure it out, and you know you figured it out, it's actually exciting. It's like having a psychic in your head or something.
Psychic dreams.
Yes.
And one more thing, because, wow, time is really flying here. We have about 23 minutes left. But this is one that I'm sure a lot of people are going to go, oh, no, here we go. But you wrote about knowing thyself and pretty much writing down and acknowledging our own personal faults.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, you know, it's so easy to blame everything going on in our lives on the addiction and on the addict. And, you know, for me, as I started to get healthy, I had to realize that it wasn't my husband's fault that we were in, you know, the financial shape that we were in. I was a part of that. It wasn't my husband's fault that I was depressed, because I had really control of how I feel. And there are so many things that I allowed myself, as we talked about earlier in the show, allowing yourself to be a victim. And none of us, I can't say none of us are victims, because obviously there are things that happen to people that there's no doubt, you know, you're a victim. If a child is abused, that's a victim. But when you're in a marriage and you're allowing things to happen, or in a relationship and you're allowing things to happen, you're allowing it. And you have to realize that you are responsible for the choices you make, and responsible for setting your own goals, and responsible for your own happiness, because nobody else can make you happy. Only you can do that. And I think that's the big one, is realizing that your happiness is really your responsibility, and you're not going to find that in anyone else. And it's just taking responsibility for your life.
And that's so true. And once we get to that point where we've taken responsibility and we're ready for the next step, we've taken responsibility, we've acknowledged it, and then we're ready to start reprogramming ourselves, our lives, the way that we think, the way that our self-perceptions, everything about what we have done and how we're going to do it from that point on, we need to learn how to reprogram everything about what we do.
Yes. And for me, when I started really making positive changes, I had written out a whole plan for myself, and it encompassed everything from exercise and health to setting goals to starting my own financial, you know, savings and money coming in. And what I found is, earlier in my marriage, I always felt that our finances were up to my husband. You know, I wasn't working early in our marriage, and I never thought that I could be responsible to make an income, you know, that could actually support myself and, you know, all of these things I felt were my husband's responsibility. But when I started really setting goals, what amazed me is as I started setting the goals and then doing affirmations and visualization and really seeing these goals, I mean, I now make twice the money my husband makes, but I would have never believed that was possible before I started this journey. And it really is about setting a goal in your mind and knowing that you're capable of it, but then for me it was about affirming it, visualizing it, believing it, and as I started moving that direction, I realized that I had way more power in my life than I ever gave myself credit for. And any of us have that power. We all have that power to change our lives, you know, aside from what anyone else does. We can actually make all of the changes and create, and that's really what the, you know, when the book says helping your loved one get clean while creating the life of your dreams, when you start taking steps to really create your dream life, it in return creates this environment that makes it the healthiest possible environment for the addict to get well. It's not a guarantee that the addict is going to take those steps with you, but at least you're opening the doorway and leading the way, and hopefully the addict is going to be strong enough to kind of take that path with you and start coming that way with you. But it's about creating your own dreams first. Create the dreams, start moving toward them, and regardless of whether or not the addict in your life gets clean, you can create the life of your dreams.
And that's once again, it's so true, but again, you know, like they say, it's easier said than done. So once we actually, you know, get to that point, we not only have to see it, but we have to believe it.
Yes. And, you know, belief doesn't have to come right away. I found a lot of times I would set goals that maybe I truly didn't believe I was capable of. But the more I affirmed it and the more I visualized it, the more I started to believe it. And I think it was a process of, you know, it's just like they say, act happy until you really are happy. Or sometimes you really can kind of push yourself in that direction, even if you don't truly believe it. You know, set a goal that maybe is a little bigger than you think is, you know, if it's too big, it may be too grandiose for you to ever grasp. But at least set it bigger than you think, you know, typically you set a goal. And keep pushing yourself that way and just keep affirming it and seeing it. And eventually the belief does start to come around. And then when you truly have that inner belief, that's when changes really start happening. And, you know, I don't think you have to necessarily believe it from the get-go, but if you keep pushing yourself that direction and keep saying affirmations and keep visualizing it, you will find yourself achieving goals bigger than you thought you could achieve to begin with.
Right. But I think that you can't get the clear vision until you get to that point where you truly believe. Because, you know, it reminds me, so many people, you know, there's the dreamers and the doers. And some people
yes.
never believe enough in themselves or their dream to actually pursue it by whatever means necessary, of course, within the confines of law. But they never get to that point, and they have to believe it. Once they see it, they have to believe it. And then and only then will the vision become clear, and then their path will become clear so that they will be on that road to creating that life or that dream life that they want for themselves.
Yes, that's true. And I think the other thing you kind of touched on, I just wanted to mention too, is, you know, I think just visualizing it isn't enough, because that does make the difference between a dreamer and an actual, actually being able to achieve the goal or just dreaming. If we just get stuck in only visualizing it and seeing it, but we're never actually taking steps toward it, I think it has to be a combination, because you know, I think a lot of books that talk about visualization lead you to believe that if you see it clear enough in your mind and you believe it strong enough, it will happen. But I also believe you have to take some steps, because if you're only visualizing it and you're not taking any physical steps kind of toward it at the same time, you could get stuck in the dreaming aspect of it and never quite achieve the goal. I mean, obviously, if you're dreaming of a promotion and all you do is visualize and say affirmations, but you never make any real steps at work toward that promotion, you know, you're probably not going to achieve that. So I think it's a combination of, you're absolutely right, you have to believe it's possible, see it clearly in your mind, affirm it, and then take action as well. And I think it's a combination of all of those things.
Exactly. And once that happens, then, you know, there is something to be said for that power of positive thinking and just doing positive things, because, of course, if you keep the negativity around you, negativity is going to continue to come to you. So we need to change that thought pattern. We need to get those, make those dreams reality. We need to really start to work on bringing them to light, you know. And one thing that you had touched on, of course, is going back and rereading through the journals and everything that you put on paper. Reread it again. And I think that that's a good point, because it helps to keep, you know, I know for me it would help keep me grounded. It would help keep me on the straight and narrow. It would help keep me focused. And, you know, it would remind me of some of the mistakes I may have forgotten about. You know, I'm getting up in age now, so I may have forgotten. So it would bring it back to the forefront. So,
and the big thing is it can remind you of the progress you've made. I know when I go back and I look at journals from years ago, I'm amazed at the progress that's been made and the changes that I've made. And I think that's huge, too, to be able to look back and go, wow, I really did. I wanted to do that, and I accomplished it. And look at all these things that over the last few years I've been able to do, or I've grown or changed. And so that's a big one, too, being able to really give yourself the pats on the back and realize, wow, you've grown a lot.
Right, right. And we're coming down the wire here on our show. So one thing that you wrote about was, of course, Just Say Yes. And there was a segment in your book, I do a lot of this from memory, but I believe that you had spoken about some people come into your life for certain reasons.
Yeah.
And I do believe that, once again, as I spoke about at the beginning of the show, divine timing. And for me, for instance, for all of our listeners, what better way to end? This was, for me on Healing the Earth, this was our month to celebrate men. So what better way to end the month than, you know, how does the adage go, behind every good man is a great woman. So this was a wonderful way to bring to a close our celebration. We weren't knocking men. This was a celebration of men this month. And, I you just brought it home nicely. Because this, for all of us who may have someone out there who is struggling with some type of an addiction, once again, your book is a great, great guideline for anyone going through this. And if you don't need it for yourself, because some people are still walking around in denial, you know, maybe you'll wake up someday, so get it for that day. Or if you know someone who's going through this, pick up a copy of this book. Pick up a few if need be, because this book gives you so much great information. And, you know, Lisa, I jumped around a bit from the book, and I wanted to end our discussion with one major point, because you had it broken down nicely into certain steps and things that you could do. But the main point in all of this, and I wanted to end our segment with this, is the fact that you spoke about prayer.
Yes. Yeah, you know, when it really comes down to it and you're talking about something like addiction, you know, and that's really what, when it comes down to letting go, and that's one of the first questions you asked about, letting go, and really you have to turn to faith because you don't have control over the situation, and you really have to realize that there is a higher plan for the person that you love. And it's funny because, I mean, it's not funny, but I always prayed for my son. It just was a natural thing to always do that. But for some reason, when it came to my husband, I wasn't praying for him. And just recently, I had another woman, because I was sharing this chapter in a reading, and she said the same thing. She said, you know, I pray all the time, but for some reason, I don't pray for my husband, and I don't know why that is. And I think we get so caught up in anger and hurt that we stop really turning to faith and prayer for that loved one. And I found for me that to finally turn to prayer, and somehow when things were going bad, if I stopped and I prayed for the situation and let it go to God, that somehow everything always seemed to be better. And whether it was my own thought process that I was seeing things in a more loving way, or whether those prayers were being answered, or for whatever reason it was working, the fact is that prayer worked. And I would just say that we really do, when it comes down to it, have to turn to our faith and have faith that things are going to be okay, and that the person we love is going through this for a reason, and they're learning their lessons just as we have to learn our lessons. And so absolutely, I think that having faith and turning to prayer was a huge step for me, and it really helped the situation.
And you are so right about that, because sometimes that's pretty much all that we may have left is our faith. And we need to learn how to put one foot in front of the other and walk by that faith and believe that we will come through. So I want to thank you for joining me here this evening on Healing Through Hurt. And if you could tell our listeners one more time how they could acquire copies of your book.
You can go to my website at soaringabovecoaddiction.com. It's also available on all the online book sellers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and you can also order it at any of the bookstores. And it's also available on all of the ebook formats, Kindle, Nook, any of the ebook formats. And I just wanted to thank you for having me on the show. I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate you letting me come join you tonight.
Oh, thank you so much for, you know, even believing enough. And, you know, like you said, you were just coming across and you saw me on a site that was requesting guests. And I just, you know, each week I'm so in awe and so appreciative that people actually take the time to communicate with me and write and send your work and just come on Healing Through Hurt, because each week, you just don't know. It's just so wonderful for me. I'm still in shock and awe over all of this. And having guests such as yourself here, I love it. I just love it. And,
you're providing a huge service to, you know, an entire community. So thank you for what you do.
Oh, thank you so much. And, I hope that we can keep in touch. You know, I'll write from time to time, give you a call, see how you're doing, you know, have you back for an alumni show.
Thank you. And I hope that your friend finds the courage that she needs to take the steps that hopefully finds her happiness.
Yeah, she's, it's baby steps, but, you know, she has me. And she always says, I have no one. But I said, you know what? You have me. And now you have Lisa's words from afar, and you can come back and listen to this show anytime she needs it. So, you know, tonight, Miss Kay, this show is dedicated to you. So, you know, thank you again. And wow, it's been a great show. And for all of our listeners, do go out tonight. My guest has been Lisa Ann Espich. Her book is Soaring Above Co-Addiction, Helping Your Loved One Get Clean While Creating the Life of Your Dreams. Excellent book. Excellent book. Great, great information in it to help you through this type of a storm. And it can apply to so many different issues and people when you're in relationships where you're going through this with someone. Get this book. It is great. And Lisa, you have a great evening. And,
thank you so much.
I pray.
And don't stay up till 3 in the morning.
I won't.
Take your bath.
I will. Thank you again.
Okay.
You have a great evening.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all for joining me here this evening on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I look forward to seeing you all tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time for our Sunday morning meditation. And, of course, this is the part that so many of you might not like, but we will not be here next week. I am taking a week off for some downtime, and we will be back on April the 9th, where my special guest will be Ms. Inez Riley. She is the author of the book Covenant, another dynamic lady. You're going to enjoy hearing all about her book. And, again, thank you so much. But stop by. And, of course, if you'd like to reach us, you can give us a call at 202-618-2556. Or you can write to us at Post Office Box 272, Randallstown, Maryland, 21133. Just address it to Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. And make it to my attention, Maria. And, of course, if you want to email me, you can email me directly at mariawall@thewallfoundationinc.org. Healing Through Hurt is part of the Wall Foundation, Incorporated, which is a faith and community-based 501c3 organization. And once again, of course, come back, follow us, click the follow button, and tell your friends about our programs. And, of course, on Facebook, if you'd like us there, you can find us on the Healing Through Hurt iTalk Radio. That is it for this evening. Once again, my guest this evening was Lisa Ann Espich, author of Soaring Above Co-Addiction, Helping Your Loved Ones Get Clean While Creating the Life of Your Dreams. Great book, great lady. Thank you all for joining me here. I will see you back here again in 2 weeks on April the 9th with Inez Riley, author of Covenant. Until then, you be blessed. Have a great week, and I will see you soon.
Oh, pretty baby, since you left me, I have been feeling oh so blue. I always thought that you would love me. I don't know what I should do. Do-do.